so I'm here with our colleague and friend, Sarah Michelle Moore, and we're going to talk a little about this whole concept of dealing with resistance with clients, which is just a never-ending issue with the variety of clients we deal with. And I was wondering, you know, maybe we could start by sharing the different settings we've worked in, because I know, you know, resistance may manifest different depending on the settings we've all worked in. So I know, like, I've worked in, well, currently, like, a private practice setting, and then worked a little bit in community mental health for a few years down in Pike County at Scioto Paint Valley Mental Health, and also for a little over 7 years at Columbus Springs Dublin at their inpatient assessment department. So it's kind of manifested a little differently. Well, you've worked in a variety of settings, yeah, too.
So I've worked in inpatient child adolescent. I did that for about 4.5 years. I've worked kind of on the other end, in home with children with autism, children and adolescents with autism. I've done inpatient adult at Columbus Springs East, so working with substance abuse and severe mental illness and the suicidal ideation and stuff like that. And then outside of mental health, kind of, because you can't really get away from mental health.
Sure.
I've worked in women's health, so I've worked a lot with pregnant, postpartum, and trying to conceive mamas who are struggling with depression, anxiety, and that type of thing.
Yeah. But this topic of resistance, I think, is so important because, I mean, I think that's one of the scariest things for most of our colleagues is, like, how do I deal with a, quote, resistant client? And, you know, when I think of that, you know, the first things that come to mind, well, obviously, the loud client who doesn't want to receive help, like the family member or somebody else is saying, you've got to do this, whether it's like a court-mandated person or like an inpatient, someone who's involuntarily committed, or maybe someone who just doesn't see that they, need help. All the way on the end of the continuum, like maybe someone who's psychotic, who has lost touch with reality, who doesn't understand that the things they're seeing and hearing are not real. So, you know, when I think of resistance, there's that, and then I also think of the silent resistance of just the maybe lack of cooperation, like in a private practice, like maybe a teenager feels like their family just made them come in and they're like, I don't need to waste my time doing this.
Yeah, it seems like there's the, kind of conscious resistance and unconscious resistance where, they're intentionally like, nope, I don't need this. I don't need therapy. I don't need you. I'm just going to sit here and bide my time. And then, like you said, there's the more unconscious of, someone who's actively hallucinating or someone who's actively manic who just doesn't think that they need help. And so that's just not even an area on their, it's not even on their radar.
Yeah. Well, and I remember in my early grad school days, we were always taught, like, initially, so, wow, it was like 20 years ago, the whole idea of defense mechanisms, all those Freudian things about, projection and rationalization and all of that, and it was like, these are bad things. But I think it's interesting, the more I read about how the tables have turned, where now it's like, this isn't bad, this is just part of, who we are. We all do them, like I do them, you do them, but it's more like as you build like a therapeutic alliance with a client, eventually it'll come out and maybe not seeing it as like a ominous bad thing, but almost like something we can work with,
Right. Because if you see, especially if you see a specific defense mechanism, you can work with that.
Yeah.
It's not some secret thing that's hidden that you're trying to get to. If you see, one of their defense mechanisms, especially when it's clear.
Yeah, one of the things that I also thought was interesting in studying for when I teach continuing ed stuff is the concept of even with resistant clients, what's the smallest goal that you and the client can agree to. So I've thought of like clients that were like court mandated. They're like, I want to get the bleepity bleep court off my back. You know, they don't know what they're doing. They got the story wrong. These such and suches are after me and da da da. And so rather than trying to, you know, argue about whose story is right or wrong, it's like, okay, sometimes maybe the therapy goal is, okay, what can we do to get the court off your case? What can we do to, you know, show that your behavior is not needing like constant follow-up or probation or someone tracking you or that you're not a danger to yourself or others. I even, you know, when I work with, let's say, teens who don't want to be here, I always tell them, you know, I'm sure you have somewhere you'd rather be. I'm sure you'd rather be hanging out with friends or listening to your music or doing hobbies. Like, and they're surprised because they're like, wow. And I'm like, my goal is not to keep you somewhere you don't want to be, but I have to have something tangible to be able to say, like, you know what? Okay, this is what you're doing to at least make the most of it. So,
right. I think it's important to find things, especially with like the adolescents in the session, that they can do while you're chatting. So maybe it's not as tedious. One of the things that we did a lot, and even on the adult units, but on the, especially on the child adolescent unit, is we did a lot of puzzles, like, word puzzles, and we did a lot of coloring, because you can get a lot out over coloring, you know, even, a 17-year-old, they don't have to be six, you know, most people, if they sit down and start coloring, get focused on the coloring, and maybe some of their defenses do come down, maybe they do, especially if you're coloring with them, start, you know, to form that alliance, start to trust you a little bit more, and may be more open to talking.
I like that you're hitting on something that I didn't think of. Sometimes, well, two pieces. One, just the interpersonal nature of counseling, that, like, just the relational. It's like it doesn't have to be so ultra, like, theoretical, like we're doing this certain technique. You know, sometimes just being with the person in that safe space and creating that opens up an opportunity. And secondly, I like that you're talking about, you know, it doesn't have to be just direct talking, like the metaphor. Like, it could be art, it could be activities therapy, it could be, there's a variety of types of therapy, like narrative therapy, storytelling, you know, different kind of things that eventually, whatever the presenting concerns are, that they'll come out, you know, in the course of the relationship.
One of my favorites with really young kids, to kind of get through that resistance, especially kids that maybe are struggling with some oppositional defiance, you know, that type of behavior, is bibliotherapy.
Yeah.
So using children's books to kind of set the tone and then having an activity within that. So you get them interested by, you know, the pictures and the book and then, like, have an activity based on the book. It added some structure, but also, you know, children aren't read to as much as they should be, and it activates different parts in their brain. So, you know, kind of adding that in is adding another layer to work with the little ones.
Yeah, I think that's good. And the other thing that I think the bibliotherapy, and even, you know, with kids especially, using like puppets or characters or whatever, is it makes it feel like less of a threat. So it's not like we're coming in talking about your bad behavior, client. We're talking about, how can we help so-and-so? Like, I personify, for example, with anger management, a lot of people don't want to, quote, go to somebody they think they're going to get in trouble with. But for me to do, like, there's workbooks and things out there, like the Angry Monster workbook, where things is like, how in the world did this person, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how did they keep the volcano from exploding? How did this character calm down? How did, so I use a lot of stories because it's easier, or it feels easier to the client, for them to help this character. And then they're doing something like, oh, wow, and they're learning kind of indirectly, so. And a lot of times I'll even have kids, after they learn techniques in the session, almost like, oh, what could we do to help someone else, you know, learn and practice this? So I'll even tell them, hey, maybe you can teach your friends, maybe you can tell someone else. So So it's kind of like reinforcing and generalizing skills too. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Yeah. And a lot of these things, I know we're talking about kids, but honestly, when our clients come in wounded, a lot of these things work with adults. It may sound like, oh, working with clay or painting or bibliotherapy, but I mean, for adults, they can be just as effective as kids, you know, so.
Play therapy and sand therapy with adults can be good. Think of the like Zen garden playing in the sand. That can be really calming for the anxious adult and help them open up a little bit more too.
Yeah, and I like that we're focusing on just the holistic sense, you know, because I think one of the things that sometimes, I remember when I was, like, going through my grad school internship, you know, I tended to hyper-focus on what I had just learned about all these theories and techniques, and the fact is I found that some of the best therapeutic interactions have been the ones where it's just, like, there's that realness, there's that sincerity, and just, like, more of a holistic, okay, we're on this mutual journey together, you know, what is just going to be most effective, and it doesn't have to be ultra clinical in terms of, you know.
It doesn't have to be, okay, we're using CBT, and that's all we're using today.
Right.
There are always, you know, different techniques that are kind of interspersed through every session. I think you're almost doing a disservice to yourself and the client if you get stuck on one clinical piece and not on the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think with resistance, you know, we talk about the resistant client, but I also think one of the things we can't neglect is our own self-care as therapists or as mental health providers, because the atmosphere we set, the tone, the vibe we set, you know, let's say we're exhausted from a late night of studying or something happened at home or a personal issue, I mean, that gets communicated to clients. I can't tell you how many clients during their first session I've asked them, have you been to any therapist before? And what did you like or dislike? Just to get a sense. I've had people tell me other therapists prior to coming here had fell asleep on them in sessions, ate their lunch the whole time during the session, talked on the phone to other people during their session time. You know, just basic things that should be no-nos, you know, and ethical and professional, you know, behavior. But yet, you know, they're basic things. Or even how we set up the environment. You know, is it welcoming or is it chaotic, you know?
Right,
so
right. Definitely. I think, too, how we go into the session and are able to deal with resistance can decrease that resistance. Mm-hmm. So, like you said, you know, kind of our mood or our, you know, if we're exhausted or whatever. And I think, you know, sometimes you come in and you have that resistant client who's just going to sit there and not do anything. And, you know, part of you wants to be like, okay, well, we'll just sit here then. Like, if you're not, we'll just sit here and we'll see what happens. But in some ways that can become almost punitive. Like, I'm going to punish the client because they don't want to talk versus trying to, like, get them involved in an activity or something. Like, okay, you don't want to talk right now. Well, let's play cards. Like, while we, you know, as you get comfortable. Like, there are things kind of to expand into versus, you know, just it being like, okay, well, if you don't want to talk, we'll just sit here.
Yeah, I think that's important. And one of the things I remember back in the day that they discussed a lot was, like, you know, this whole idea of the expert role. I think, you know, there are some people who come to us because they're like, oh, you have more education. How do I deal with blah, blah, blah issue? But I think one of the things that can really push a lot of clients away is when we try to come across as, you know, very strong in that expert role rather than, you know what, when they can tell we've lived through life, maybe not the exact same circumstances they have, but when we try to identify, like, common aspects of humanity of what we feel, of what they might be going through, of, like, hey, let's sit and talk about this journey together. Tell me your story. Like, what do you want it to be? Kind of almost like, take me on your journey with you, and then what do we want to see the next chapter of that being is a lot more welcoming than, you know, like, sounding like we're just shooting out a list of questions and, you know, being in the expert role where it's like, okay, we're imposing treatment goals on them, or we're giving them a checklist, like, we're doing this, 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 this. But basically, even the language we use, I think the language we use in therapy needs to be a language of partnership. This right. is a voluntary process, you know, and then also hearing, you know, even I put in quotes sometimes their own words in terms of their treatment goals too.
Right, right. Instead of kind of taking on that like authoritarian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or even utilizing the medical model, like kind of that top-down approach, versus more of a, like you're walking it together. I think sometimes we can fall into a trap when we do try to be like go into that, you know, authority, like we're kind of in charge, because all of a sudden you realize that you're doing more work than the client's doing. Mm-hmm. Like, well, why isn't the client doing the work? Why am I doing it all?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I put it all on myself. Like, so you kind of have to take a step back and look, like, is it the client who's like, I'll let them do all the work? Or did mm-hmm. you make the decision to
yeah.
kind of lead and, you know, this is how it ended up?
So some of that might be reevaluating, like, almost like cognitive behavioral therapy on ourselves. Like, do we have those roles of I'm the helper, I'm the fixer, I'm responsible for right. the success or failure of therapy, as opposed to this is a journey, and just like life has its ups and downs, the journey of therapy is going to have its ups and downs.
Right, right.
That's why I like using, in combination with other techniques, you know, something like a strengths-based solution-focused approach, because it uses language like, how have you managed? Wow, you know, you're telling me you're depressed and stressed and you have this and that going on, but yet you still are showing up at work. Yet you still are doing this and that. You know, for some people, that's a new concept. Like, there is something they did right, and they don't necessarily come in thinking that. And that really plants a seed of, oh, okay. It's just more optimistic
right.
than us coming in like, yeah, you're messed up. Let me help you get back on track.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think initially, especially when we're starting out as therapists, we just feel like it's just scary. Like, oh, no, this person doesn't want to be here. I have to motivate him or her. But instead of thinking of, like, from without, it's like, okay, again, like I said, what's the smallest goal we can agree to? And just other like the atmosphere, like, I remember some of the settings I was in. One setting, I had a shared office space with two other gentlemen with their private practices, and they would, like, have bottled waters or mints or just, you know, they had, like, a fountain running or just different things that were a little bit more of a calming atmosphere. Or at the hospital setting, we had a number of, like, homeless people or people who were so stressed that they hadn't eaten in days. So something as simple as food, water, drink, sleep, you know, basic yep. stuff. Like, I think sometimes we try to get so, quote, deep that we forget, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like, okay, let's start with the basic, you know?
Right, right, exactly. That sandwich can mean
yeah.
a lot to the patient coming in, you know, who hasn't had a meal in 3 days.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and also, you know, while we're doing that non-judgmental stance, because I've seen, and you might have seen, you know, some colleagues are like, oh boy, here, okay, fine, you know. Like, I remember one guy, bless his heart, but I don't know how long it had been since he ate, and he went through, like, 3 box lunches. He just kept, like, we're like, oh, wow, you know, some people would make comments, but I thought, you know what, wow, like, if something to us that might seem that small is that meaningful to him, you know,
right.
and showing a genuineness of like, okay, then, you know, we take kind of, I don't know if I want to say excuses, but we take those things away so that they can open up about another level of things, you know.
Right, because even, you know, going back to that, you know, subconscious or unconscious resistance. Mm-hmm. If you're hungry,
yeah, oh, yeah.
like there's gonna be resistance there.
Oh yeah.
Whether it's intentional or not, because you're hungry.
Yeah.
You know, if you're exhausted, there's mm-hmm. gonna be resistance there because you're exhausted. You can't think. You can't, you know, mm-hmm. answer questions. You know, so those are ways that seem small, like you said,
yeah.
but to build trust. Mm-hmm. To build that rapport so that, mm-hmm. you know, they will be able to talk to you and they will be able to open up. You know, if there are those barriers coming in, it's going to be hard to get anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've known people, you know, say, especially in an inpatient setting, say they're tired, they haven't slept, they, you know, whether it's because they were manic or on substances and they're coming down, or whether just life stress that they, you know, some people that are depressed can be, have psychomotor retardation, but some can just like, oh, you know, I'm up for days, you know, maybe saying, you know what, I'm not going to shove a bunch of paperwork in your face to try and make you stay awake and do now. I'll get you the main highlights of what you need, but let me facilitate, like, helping you get to your room or have a nap or whatever and stuff. So they're like, oh, wow, I'm more than just, you know, a number or someone to sign paperwork or someone to get money from or whatever. So.
And you know, taking that forward into more like a private practice setting,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned the fountains. I love fountains.
Yeah, oh,
so, like,
too.
The Sally fountains I love. Or like even, you know, having bottled water.
Yeah.
Or having, you know, just like some of those like comforts of home.
Yeah.
Can be really nice. You have pillows. There are pillows on this couch.
Yeah,
like, I think that's comforting. And you see as clients walk in, like, where they sit and, like, like put a pillow on their lap or not.
Yeah.
And it's comforting.
Yeah.
You know, to have that pillow. And so, you know, little things like that in an, you know, outpatient setting can bring a little bit of that, like, hominess into.
Well, and I've also seen in different settings, and I know this may sound like a silly thing to bring up, but different types of seating, like different size chairs. Like, you know, people have different body types. I remember there was a guy assessed at a place I used to work who was being assessed for, like, bariatric surgery. So we had to use the group rooms because that agency only had chairs in the offices with arms on them that were fairly tight. So I think it's important to have a variety of seating, even if you're dealing with young people. Some of them might want, like, a beanbag chair or a whatever, just something that is comfortable for them, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, things that, again, I think a lot of the stuff with resistance, while I explain in the seminar about, you know, yeah, there's some clinical things we can consider, there's also some very practical things we can consider. You know, keep in mind the whole idea, like, first impressions mean everything. You know, it's like, yeah, we might have had a tiring day. We might just have gotten done with some of our roughest clients, and then someone comes in. We might be their first interaction of the day. So it's like, what are we conveying? Is it like, oh, welcome, you know? Mm-hmm. Or are we de-escalated enough? Or are they going to be like, oh, gosh, this person really doesn't want to hear from me, you know?
And sometimes it might mean taking a couple minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I know that I hate running late. Like, that's one of my biggest, like, I want to be running on time. But, you know, if you have a client that you just saw that you had to hospitalize, and then you have another client coming back to back, you might need 5 minutes to, like, breathe and get yourself back into a good headspace before you bring the next client back. So that you can be present and, you know, able to give your undivided attention, because it's hard to give your undivided attention when, if you're still thinking about, like, what's going on with, you know, the client you just sent to the hospital.
Sure.
So it's, you know, that can be helpful too, just taking a few minutes to breathe and, you know, use a little mindfulness on yourself and center yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I think we can't minimize the importance of, like, collegial, like, relationships. Because I know we talk about, like, formal supervision, but the fact is, even if someone has whatever the highest level of licensure is in their respective field, I think the importance of, one, for ethical purposes, just standard of care and making sure we're doing what other people in similar boat would do, but also just people that we can vent to, hear, you know, because it helps also for us to normalize. I remember there were a few situations I ran by some of my colleagues when I had some tougher cases, and I was rather hard on myself, and I was like, oh, my gosh, am I doing this, that? And it was so refreshing to hear, like, man, I'd be just as stressed if I dealt with that, you know, and then to be able to document that, yeah, I spoke with these people, you know, in terms of standard of practice, and we're all kind of on the same wavelength, and, you know, you have a background, because, You know, I think we can feel isolated in our field. Like, whether it be private practice because there's less people around, or I remember feeling isolated even when I worked at a certain community mental health center, because even though there might be 22 people in the building that are, you know, employees there, everybody was just so slammed with all the productivity standards that a chance to actually sit and talk and meet and, you know, like, it didn't happen. So, yeah, so to have that is really important.
Right.
And it might be something we even have to seek out, because sometimes our settings don't give that. Like, some settings I was in, they highlighted a lot of the, what I call, like, administrative supervision, like the procedures and how paperwork's done. And while those are important things, you know, sometimes we need more support in other areas, like the actual cases and whatever. So having that balance too. So, yeah. So, and I think resistance, when I think of that, also requires just flexibility. So that balance where it's not like just having rigid rules, but having, so I think of like one thing they talked about in the literature, for example, is a gentleman who had a cane with him in a setting, and some people were like, oh, he can't have that cane, he might crack someone in the head, he might do this. And other people were like, well, I mean, if he's calm and cooperative and there's no reason to argue with him, you know, why are we going to make this a big deal? So I think kind of choosing our battles, or, you know, if there's someone who has a purse or has something, you know, like in certain settings, it's like, okay, how do we balance out, you know, policies and procedures with still being just humanistic and caring and, you know, taking each situation as it comes?
Right. I think part of that is having clear boundaries, and you don't necessarily have to have a lie. You know, it's when I worked in child adolescence, sometimes you would be like, oh my gosh, there's so many rules. Why do we have so many rules? And it's because someone did something and now we have a rule.
Sure.
But I think having few but clear boundaries can help with resistance, because, you know, you can have as many snacks as you want, you can have whatever, you can have it, like, this is the boundary though, like, you know, it's here for a reason. I think when the boundaries are clear and understandable, it can make that a little bit easier.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think that goes also for our stress level. Mm-hmm. If we're in a setting, like whatever that work setting may be, where it's, we're not really clear what the expectations are, like, you know, that brings a lot of stress and contributes a lot to burnout, instead of a setting where it's like the boundaries are clear, but there's also enough flexibility for creativity, you know. So I think it's important to also look at for ourselves, is the setting we're working in a good match with who we are, you know,
right.
Whatever that may be in the mental health field. Sometimes just changing settings can do wonders, you know.
Agreed.
Yeah. Or how we schedule people. I mean, I remember when I worked in community mental health, they had a few secretaries who traditionally scheduled for everyone. Now, my productivity numbers were pretty good, so I talked with the director, and I'm like, can I do my own scheduling? And she's like, yeah, I'm going to let you do that, because for me, I kind of knew, like, if clients had certain issues, like, this is how many ultra-depressed people I can have back-to-back, or borderlines, or this or that, but I'll still meet my productivity. Mm-hmm. Some other people might not meet their productivity, or might not, you know. So how we schedule things, I think, makes a difference.
Definitely.
So, like, for me, blocking time is important. So in theory, I know this in reality isn't as neat, but, like, you know, trying to have time for notes, a block of time for that, a block of time for calls, and then so many sessions of clients. So just to be able to get done the different aspects of what we need, you know.
Right, for sure. Because there's always unexpected. You're always going to have an unexpected emergency client who comes in
mm-hmm.
that you didn't plan on taking as much energy as they do. But like you said, there's ones you can plan. And if you can plan, then it's best to be able to do that, so that you can be emotionally prepared for the next one and the one after that, like, you know, to the best of your ability.
Well, and I like also in the literature they talk about the concept of caseload versus workload. So it's not necessarily how many clients you have, but are the types of clients a reasonably healthy match with what your skill level, your competency, your emotional wherewithal, you know.
Right.
And so, I mean, I could have more clients and they're a good match, or I'm able to schedule or balance my day well, versus I could have less clients, but they be the ones that really push my buttons and I
right.
don't know.
Definitely.
That's where I think it's reasonable, and I know every agency doesn't give a ton of opportunity for this, but I always encourage people, if you can, try and set periodically some meetings with your supervisor, you know, just to discuss, these are my strengths, these are the types of clients that I deal better with or not as good with, I want to be an asset to clients, I feel like this is something I can do better with, and even with colleagues, the one team that I dealt with at one of my settings, I remember we had a few really intense grief and traumatic cases come in, and two of the other women I worked with were like, oh no, I can't do this. This is just too tough. And for me, that grief part wasn't as bad as some other issues. So we kind of talked through like, okay, then if you're willing to take this, I'll take the client with blah, blah, blah issues. So,
right, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, it goes back to that supporting each other.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. And the team, too, you know. I think, you know, in theory, like, we make these divisions about, okay, this person's the doctor, the nurse, the therapist, the caseworker, the whatever. And it's like, you know, there's overlap between what we're doing, but if we really are all about the client and his or her well-being and, you know, just overall mental health and wellness, then it's like, okay, how can we convey that team approach? So,
Definitely. Yeah.
So, yeah, with resistance, I guess the main thing that I just think of, it's over time, if anything. I'm not saying it's comfortable or I'm happy about it, but it's like, I think it's a little less scary than it was 25 years ago when I started out, where it's like, okay, that's just this. And then I think in my own life, I'm sure the people that are close to me, maybe they won't use the word resistant, but in our day-to-day life, our spouses, our kids, or other people might find us challenging to deal with at times. So I try to think about, okay, the common humanity I have with these clients. You know, whether I understand or have gone through the exact same issue as that person, it's like, how can I relate with the feelings, the feeling of the anxiety of open-endedness, the fear of what's going to happen next when I'm not sure about a situation, or the sadness of life not going the way I wanted. Okay, maybe I can relate to that even if I haven't gone through what they're coming in with. And I think clients can tell when we're genuine about that.
Okay.
And that just really lessens resistance. But, I actually, in some ways, think now, too, when resistance starts to come up with clients, that as weird as this sounds, it can actually be a good thing because it gives you something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, you know, when clients first come in, they may be kind of just feeling out the atmosphere like, okay, yeah, can I really trust this person? How much can I really share the story? How much are they in this for the paycheck that we don't really have, but they think we have? Or, you know, are they really genuinely concerned? And so when they see that, I think just the walls lessen. So, yeah. So just inviting them to share their story and being with them in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've known times where sometimes therapists, you know, would cry with a client if they're going through something, or would just mirror some of the client's feelings. Or I've had clients that have gone through horrible abuse and trauma, and I remember some of the women that had some post-traumatic stress stuff where I said, you know, have you ever thought that God or your family member or whoever, your best friend, would probably feel just as angry about what has happened to you as you are. And they're like, wow, it's like, you know, the idea that, yeah, it's okay to feel, you know, that. And there's freedom and acceptance and mercy and, you know, and I keep in mind, you know, looking at what purpose does the resistance serve. Mm-hmm. And it just reminds me that it serves a need for them. You know, someone who, let's say, has a personality disorder of some sort and has felt like they couldn't trust anybody, they just didn't, there was no stability in their life, what would even make them think that I would be any bit different, you know? And so kind of keeping that in mind that, like, for us as therapists or whatever, it's not personal. It might feel personal. Clients sometimes use personal language, like, you don't give a darn. You just want your paycheck. You don't understand me. But realize they might be using that language, but it's their way of just trying to process things and put it in some understandable form. So, you know, it kind of almost makes us feel sadness and stuff for the client rather than anger towards the client for the resistance. So,
you have to check your counter transference at the door.
Yeah, good point. Good point. But any last words about the concept of resistance there?
I don't think so.
Yeah. So again, resistance doesn't have to be a scary thing. It's a real thing. But again, as you've heard in our discussion, it can be a mixture of procedural stuff. Sometimes there's safety in sticking to procedures, but also flexibility in how we apply things, techniques, just relating to the client on his or her level, finding what commonalities we can meet them in, and just being real. You know, one of the things in the literature talked about in the multicultural literature, the number one factor that they said that clients really appreciated was sincerity. And so clients can tell when we're real about saying, yeah, I want to hear your story. I'm here for you. So I wish you well in your work with clients. Thank you. Bye.